I don't think any CLE program or trial technique program would be complete without some reference to Jerry Spence. A few years ago, I had the wonderful opportunity of going down and watching Mr. Spence try the case against McDonald's in Chicago. And I was awestruck. I was awestruck by what the man was able to do and not letting anybody know that he was doing it. You know, the first thing he did was he came into town like a Clint Eastwood movie. There was news coverage of Jerry coming into O'Hare Airport. He had on the ever-present fringe vest, no briefcase, saddlebags thrown over his shoulders, a hat that looked like out of that cartoon Ricochet, you know, the brim of the hat almost touched his shoulders, and he's smoking a long, thin cigar. And he walked through the airport alone. And I watched the newscast, and I turned to my wife, and I said, he's coming here doing the High Plains Drifter. He's coming into town setting himself up as the lone gun against the big corporation. A great tactic. And he did it from the moment he got off the plane. If he thought of it or if it was even conscious. But that's what he did. The media coverage was, here's this guy in a vest. What they didn't pay attention to was that he took over two floors of rooms in a hotel, had more word processors and a legal staff that could choke a cow, you know, and these people were buzzing the whole time he was on trial, supplying him with the information he needed, finding case law, finding sightings, totally prepared in terms of the law, but nobody saw the guys with the suede patches and the tweed coats. All they saw was the dude in the fringe vest smoking the Clint Eastwood cigar. You know, I'm going to do a panel with Jerry in a couple of weeks out in California, and I've never met the man, so I'm real excited to meet him. You know, we're going to do something on Final Argument together. And it's you know, I watched him work his trial. He tried his case to the jury while the corporate lawyers from McDonald's tried their case to him. They would sit there and say, why is he doing that? What's he doing that for? And they would have this conference, and he would, I mean, not literally, but figuratively, he was sitting on the jury rail saying, hey, Bob, what do you think about that? You know, he got it folksy. And what's the theory of the case? One man against the corporation. This guy, McDonald's, wanted to sell ready-made ice cream cones. So they made Ray Kroc, shook some guy's hand, The guy said, I can make your ice cream cones for you. What McDonald's wanted to do was reach in the freezer and come up with an ice cream cone and hand it to mom and dad rather than doing the waiting for it. You know, they wanted a ready-made ice cream cone. This guy said he could make them. He tools up his little mom and pop ice cream cone place, spends millions of dollars to get ready for this volume of business that McDonald's is going to bring him. And he, in the interim, Ray Kroc dies. Not so good when the guy whose hand you shook is no longer around. The guy makes his ice cream cone. He brings it to McDonald's. They say, we can't sell this. It's soggy. McDonald's doesn't want to be accused of selling soggy ice cream cones. A $10 million law case about soggy ice cream cones? Come on. Anyway, that's what the case boiled down to. And Jerry's point of view was, this little guy is getting screwed over by this mega corporation. What was the way he presented himself throughout the entire trial? I'm the lone lawyer against that team of blue pinstripe three-piece suit corporate lawyers. I'm alone. They're many. He was alone. McDonald's is big. Drawing this parallel constantly for the jury. Constantly, and just reinforcing it over and over again. It was a great case, you know, and it was really wonderful to see somebody get on a roll with a theme and stay with it throughout the trial. And he beat the pants off him. He beat them. He's an excellent lawyer. Aside from all of the fringe tactics, he's good. He knows the law. And he's prepared. And he knows how to do evidence. And on top of that, he's developed this style. So don't hear me saying that, you know, here's what you should hear me saying. My rap is that persuasion is an integration. Persuasion is the result of an incremental progression, right? Don't hear me saying that if you don't know the law and you don't know evidence and you don't know how to try a case, you could be persuasive in hell as hell and you're not going to win. So it, you know, the preparation, the proof and procedure and law part of it is where you begin. That's got to be a given. You know, that's the given. And then from there, you start thinking about how you develop these persuasive things that are concomitant with your style. We're going to talk about style in terms of physical expressiveness in just a minute. Here's the thing that gives lawyers the willies. There can be no persuasion without emotion. Lawyers run away from emotion, you know, like the Wicked Witch of the East runs away from water. Don't be afraid of it. Here's the out. When we talk about emotion, there was a, I have a friend who's a private criminal defense lawyer in one of the collar counties in Illinois around Chicago, and I go out to visit him every once in a while. And one day we're sitting there talking, and he looks at his watch, and he said, "Let's go down to the courthouse. Milt's doing a closing. You'll love it." And we went down to the courthouse, and here was Milt, hoary old guy, white hair, bushy eyebrows, wire-rimmed glasses. Clarence Darrow, eat your heart out. This guy looked like a crusty old lawyer. And he could get it going. He could drop that voice down and get some vibrato, and carry on. And if he was really into it, he might even cry on it. Bullshit. You know? And you sit there and you'd watch him, you know, and you could, I look around at the other lawyers who are flocking in from all over the courthouse to come and watch his closing. You know? When it works, what they say is, "Ooh, I wish I could do that." And when it blows up on him and it doesn't work, they say, "Yeah, it's not my style. I wouldn't do it that way." You know? Emotion is not the demonstration of emotion. It's the evoking of emotion that you want to focus on. Making a display of your own emotions in my business is called ham. It doesn't work in theater. It doesn't work in life, and it won't work at trial. Okay? You don't set out to demonstrate some great emotional display and get intense about something that doesn't matter, because everybody will see through it. It's fake. You know it's fake. They know it's fake. If you ain't buying it, they ain't buying it. That's the one rule of acting. If you don't believe it, they ain't going to believe it. So you might as well commit an action that you can believe. You know. So how do we get at emotions in trial? The way to get at emotion in trial is to get involved. Involvement is the way to get to the emotion. There's going to be something in every case that makes you say, "Ooh, those sons of me," you know. And there's going to be something in every case that makes you say, "They can't do that." You know, that's the germ of the emotion. That's where you start with the emotion. You don't pump it up on one word and hit some vowel sound, you know, do that bullshit. You just get to it. You get involved in the case. And your involvement in the case is going to lead you to deal with the things that you feel good about. And 9 times out of 10, if you feel good about something in a case, the jury's going to feel good about it. If you're troubled by something in a case, the jury's going to be troubled about it. You can't go away from your own instincts on those issues. You're working on the facts of a case and you say, "This is a shame. How did this ever happen?" We need, that's your emotion. That's your emotion. That's what you want to project to the jury. And the way you do that is by getting involved, by recreating the world in which that happened, recreating the events. Stanislavski, the great father of method acting, you know, taught a process called effective emotion, in which he made clear to the actors that he was working with that an emotion is a state of being. It's not an active state. You can't recreate an emotion. What you can do is you can recreate the setting around the emotion. Think about the times, you know, I mean, I could get goosebumped and teary-eyed talking about 1974 when my mom passed away. You know, I can get, but I don't, it's not emotion because I want to, you know, I get involved with where I was, what I was doing, when the phone call came, how I had to make arrangements to get from Hawaii to New Jersey. You know, you think about the whole day and how everything unfolded. And as you plug into and get involved with the setting around that incident, the emotions emerge. The emotions come out. So you've got an emotional issue that you're going to bring out. You develop it in direct examination. You work with that witness. You find out where those emotional, and you set the stage so that the jury can then personalize the experience and empathize with the emotion. And hopefully, if you're good, you'll evoke that emotion in them. That's what the TV commercials do to us. They get us to empathize with the situation. We get involved with it, and we're there emotionally, and we're ready to be moved. Yes, sir.
Believe in your client. You're being a guy on you. I mean, don't be all baloney about the fact that, oh, I'm not the jury. You know damn well, of all the people in that courtroom, you know the facts better than everyone that this guy is guilty as hell. How do you communicate that to a jury when you don't believe in the guy?
Does everybody have the question? You know, what happens when you know the guy is guilty? Well, plead him. He doesn't want to be pled. He wants to go to trial. I've worked on some rape cases, you know, where we were pretty convinced that the guy did it, you know. I worked on a death penalty case in California where the guy was on death row, and because of a bad trial to begin with, the thing got sent back from the Supreme Court, and here we were in the mitigation phase of a death. No doubt the guy did it. He's been found guilty of it, you know. I try to find some way to put the system on trial. You know, I try to find some way to find something in the procedure. You know, the police didn't do a good investigation. You know, this guy shouldn't be here because, you know, you don't even deal with the fact of whether or not he did it. The fact that somehow, maybe it's a bad Fourth Amendment case. Maybe it's some violation of the guy's Miranda rights. Maybe it's some sloppy, schlocky police investigation or lab report. You know, lab technicians are just, they get pawned off as doctors and experts all the time. You know, like the gas chromatograph machine. You don't have to be anybody special to do that. You grab a handful of gas, you throw it in a tube, and if it turns purple, you have this result. You know, it's not a great elaborate tech. I try to find some way to put the system on trial if I've got to take that guy to trial, you know. I find that easy to do because I think that the system is flawed in many ways. You know, when you come from a city like Chicago, where we have things like the Chicago phone book, which is a very interesting interrogation device that the police use. That is where they take the accused and they sit him at an interrogating table and they put a phone book on his head and beat on it until he says what they want him to say, you know. Whether or not he's guilty, I think I could make an argument about how that shouldn't be done. You know, we have lots of things that I think are arguable in those cases, but they're tough. I mean, there's no doubt. None of this is easy. It's just fun when you're doing it. You know, it's tough. You know, there are medical malpractice cases where you've got to defend the doctor who you wouldn't go to, you know. And you've got to find the way to put forth something that makes sense to the jury, that allows them to see it from this guy's point of view. Pleading is a tough way to go in a criminal matter, you know. But I think that a lot of times you owe it to the guy to do what you can to convince him. Joe Nursey, who works with Millard Farmer down in Atlanta, says your guy is charged with jumping in a car high on PCP, driving a 1958 Chevy with two disconnected rods at 90 miles an hour into a 7-Eleven window, jumping out, waving a gun, shooting the owner, taking $6 from the cash register and running away on foot. It's pretty clear that he's demonstrated poor judgment. You know, you've got to convince him that going to trial is not in his best advantage. You know, you've got to plead him the best way you can. I don't know. I really empathize with that situation. And to talk about it in the abstract is one thing. But I can say pretty categorically that if I get involved in an indefensible case, I try to find out one thing that really bothers me about the way the investigation was put together, or the way the person's rights were violated or not violated, or whichever side you're on. You've got to find something that you can argue. And there's something in every case. Otherwise, why are you going to trial? You know, and that's where I think you need to work on the defendant. Okay. I want to talk about a topic that I call physical expressiveness. And the reason I want to talk about that now is because, building off the theme of my theme of persuasion as a result of integration, I think we need to look at the ways in which we should become sort of personally integrated. I think the term in psychology is congruent. When we find a sense of personal congruence, then we're able to really flow into our ideas and be expressive with them. And I want to talk about things like stage fright. I want to talk about things like body language, and we can hopefully even get into some topics of dress and all of that. In the opera, being Italian, you know, we grew up with Madame Butterfly playing in the background a whole lot, and Tosca was my mother's favorite theme. And there were times when I felt like Mario in the household. But in the opera, there's an expression called in bocca lupa, which literally means in the wolf's teeth, in the wolf's mouth. And the way it's translated in opera is in the teeth of the wolf. And what that means is the opera singer needs to confront the audience, which is his or her petard, you know, the thing that will either elevate them to success or, you know, lead them to anonymity. In the old days, opera audiences used to throw things if they didn't like the way you sounded. They don't do that anymore, but, you know, people would. You know, there's that old joke about the opera singer who sings a great aria, and he gets an encore, and he finishes, and he gets another encore, and he gets another encore. And finally, he says to his manager, how many encores do they want? You know, and somebody yells from the upper balcony, you'll do it until you get it right. You know, you'll notice if those of you who are opera buffs will notice that there's always the moment where there's a scene going on and all of the recitative is happening, and it's like, oh, did you cook the spaghetti? No, I didn't cook the spaghetti. They're going back and forth, talking to each other in sung dialogue. And then the strains of the famous aria start to emerge from the orchestra. And at that moment, the hero or the heroine leaves the scene, sort of, and wanders down to the foot of the stage, plants, and gets ready to sing the famous aria from that act or that opera. And it's in that moment where they go from being in the play to coming out and doing the virtuoso performance that the term in bocca lupa applies. And they stand at the foot of the stage waiting for their pickup note to launch, and they look at the audience. They look directly at their critics. They look directly at the people on whose approval they're going to rise and fall. That moment is not a moment of meekness. It's not a moment of self-evasiveness. The opera singers, who are noted for their egos, not unlike actors and trial lawyers, will stand with great elan, very much like a matador. And it's in that moment where they are looking, confronting their biggest fear. And they're not apologizing for it, and they're not getting meek about it. It's just, let's get to it, sort of. And I like to think about that moment, because the moment before we begin speaking is the most incredible moment in terms of pre-speech anxiety that can happen. I mean, you may have seen me pacing up and down on the side there while Elaine was doing the introduction. You know, I don't remember a thing she said. No. The moment before you get up to speak is a very real moment of anxiety. There's a doctor in California whose name is, can't remember his first name, his last name is Motley. And Dr. Motley runs the Institute for Pre-Speech Anxiety. Talk about a California frou-frou sort of topic, huh? I have a theory about California that the country is tilted and anything that's loose ends up in California. My younger brother moved to California 10 years ago. I wonder what that said. Anyway, Dr. Motley's work with people who experience acute speech anxiety is really very revealing. He's taken people and wired them up, very much like a stress test. Have any of you ever had a stress test? Once you turn 40, it's one of the things that they do to you immediately upon walking into the doctor's office. Test proctoscope. I mean, that's it. What happens in a stress test is they wire you up like the $1 million man, and they put you on a treadmill that goes faster and tilts upward every so many minutes. So at the end of 5 minutes, you're running uphill but going nowhere. And it sort of becomes a Sisyphus-like metaphor for the entire day. You're sweating and running. And then they measure your heart rate and how fast you recover from that stress. Well, Dr. Motley wires people up in a very similar way and measures their pulse rate immediately before the speech begins. And he's gotten pulse rates up to 200 beats per minute. That's about a wink away from a stroke. You know, that's an incredible amount of exertion. I work out on a Stairmaster, as I mentioned to you, and I work out for, you know, 20 minutes, and if I'm lucky, I get my heart rate up to 140. 200 is like major stress on the system. And your brain records that stress as one thing: fear, absolute fear. You're sweating, you're perspiring, you're calling for more oxygen. There's no windows up here, you know. The brain does not know that you're standing on a treadmill, or does not know that you're only standing in front of a group of people. It could be a lion, it could be a mugger, it could be whatever, you know. So your brain says, here comes some adrenaline, whoosh, and you get this pump of adrenaline that would enable you to run a 100-yard dash in 9 flat, but you've got to stand there in front of the group of people, and that's where the heart rate goes up. And what happens psychologically at that moment is that the brain is reading fear, okay? So in order to justify the fear, we psychologically start and enter into a spiral of catastrophe. We start asking ourselves, oh, what could happen if this goes wrong? And the fears justify the adrenaline, and the adrenaline helps and you know, we're just driving ourselves nuts right before we start to speak. Interestingly enough, also what Dr. Motley measures is about 30 seconds into the speech, there's an incredible drop-off. where things fall back to normal. The heart rate comes down, the respiration sort of stabilizes. But we are so driven at that moment that we don't pay attention to the drop-off, and we continue to make ourselves cuckoo. To the point that in surveys taken around the country, the number one fear in America, number one, is the fear of public speaking. Death is third. You get the picture? Everybody, now all of these cognitive minds are sitting there saying, okay, what's two, right? Right? Number two is tied between snakes and altitudes. But the number one fear is the fear of public speaking. So much so that when we're asked to do it again, our first response is, nah, I ain't going through that, no way. You know, and then that's how it emerges as the fear. The moment of In Boca Lupa is the moment of waiting for that drop-off, the moment of waiting for things to stabilize. And there are times, there are moments, instance in the courtroom when you can wait, but most lawyers don't. Okay? How many of you have seen this happen? You're sitting at counsel table, or not you, you would never make this mistake, it's the other guy. Somebody else is sitting at counsel table, the judge looks over and says, counsel, you may proceed. The guy stands up, walks to the podium, puts down the ever-present legal pad, looks at the legal pad, looks at the witness, looks at the legal pad, looks at the witness, turns the page, looks at the legal pad, looks at the witness, then for emphasis, makes a note, looks at the witness and says, with all of this attention and all of this focus, says, state your name for the record and spell it for the court reporter. Have you seen that happen?
No.
And in that moment, you know, what's going on with this person is, oh God, what am I doing here? Right. Oh, I didn't go to a good law school and the prosecutor did. And oh God, my mother doesn't like me. Oh, I should have called her on Mother's Day. God, what's your name? Right. Why not take that moment, you know, and turn it around so that you can take an instant and sort of, you know, make sure your pads fit. That first hit in the football game, that first serve in the tennis game, that first drive, I call the first tee in golf the anxiety tee. You know, I've yet to hit a good drive off the first tee because everybody's standing around, everybody's watching, and you want to justify the cost of your new clubs, right? Whack, you send the thing to Iowa. And when you play in Chicago, Iowa is your slice. You know, it goes that way. You guys would probably send it to New Mexico. What would happen if we took, there's any number of ways to handle that scenario. What would happen if the judge says, counsel, you may proceed. The person stood up, walked to the lectern, put the pad down, if you have to have it, and looked at the jury, then to the witness. You know, just 10 seconds where you just look at the people and not panic. Take 10 seconds to say, they're more interested in what I'm going to do, right? They're more interested in the ideas that are going to happen than whether or not my dog, you know, licked my, I used to have a dog that every time I was on my way out the door in a suit, you know, he'd come over to say goodbye and I would get glick all over my leg, you know. Now I have a 3-year-old daughter who manages to, you know, kiss me with baby food and bananas as I'm on my way out the door. Invariably, I've got some stain or spot or whatever. And if I stand here and say, oh my God, they see the, you know, the orange juice on my zipper, you know, it's going to make me cuckoo, as opposed to standing here and saying, you know, I've thought about this. I've prepared it. I know exactly where I'm going to go. Let's start. Just one more example, then we'll get to the question, okay? Another thing that you might try, which helps a great deal, is when you get up. Start that question that means nothing in terms of the substance of the case. You get up from counsel table, you're moving towards the lectern. You know, would you please state your name and spell it for the court reporter? What have you done in that cross? The first thing that you've done, you stand up, everybody looks at you, the focus is on me. I don't want the focus. Focus makes me nervous. I want to put the focus someplace else. How about on the witness? Would you state your name, please, and spell it for that guy over there? So the jury is then focused on what he's going to say and what he's doing, and you're over here saying, got past the first 10 seconds, without being in focus. There are lots of little moments like that in the courtroom when you can get yourself off the hot spot. But somehow the masochistic part of us makes us stand there and say, I can take the heat, I can take the heat, oh my God, oh my God. And we start to get a little cuckoo. Sir, you had a question.
Perhaps I can get up. But when you're viewed by you for legal pain at that point and at the point of a final argument.
Okay, the question is, what are my views about using a legal pad or notes, let's say? And it is a little bit ahead of it, but what the heck? If we're not flexible, we're not anything. Notes or no notes? I'm speaking from notes right now. I wouldn't think to stand up here and do four 90-minute segments without notes. I don't feel comfortable without notes. Not only do I have an outline of what I'm going to say, I have the text written out right here on this table so that if I go blank, I know where I can go. I think that if notes make you comfortable, by all means, use notes. Some people use 3x5 cards. Some people use legal pads. The point is not whether or not you use notes. The point is whether or not the notes come into focus. Okay, if my legal pad, okay, which has an outline about personal congruency on it and the points that I want to make about how to become personally congruent, if my outline becomes the focus of my attention and I start to relate to it more than I relate to you, then don't use this. When your face is buried in the legal pad, that's where the jury is going to be buried. If you need to use, fine, but the notes should never become the focal point. You're the focal point. You're deflecting people's attention. You're getting people to look at this. You're getting people to focus on this. And here we have demonstrative evidence. And you're getting people to focus on things, but you're really the prime mover. You're the person who makes it go. If you defer your ability to move that, to be the mover, and you start focusing only on your notes, the famous, can I have a minute, judge? You know, then you get this shit going on. You know, you can't do that. You can't get the people to focus down here. You've got to get the people to focus on what's going on between you. And you do that by looking at them, by talking to them. See?